This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of years ago, I interviewed a guy named Reuben Jonathan Miller. He's an associate professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, and he had just written a book called Halfway Home about what he called the afterlife of mass incarceration, all the barriers that people face after doing their time. People, including his own brother, who needed a place to live as a condition of his parole, but who couldn't stay with Miller because Miller was in university housing.
In faculty housing, you know, you can't have people with criminal records living in your homes.
So Miller made arrangements for his brother to rent a friend's apartment.
But the dear friend ended up renting that apartment to someone else. and so we're scrambling to find him a place to stay. We eventually land on him staying in the apartment with the dear friend. And so the probation officer comes out to inspect the apartment. And I get a text message from him telling me that the probation placement has failed because my dear friend had two dogs. And people with felony records can't live in places that have large dogs. So this was the struggle.
We're going to spend some time over the next couple of months going back, talking to authors about what has happened since they wrote their books. Professor Miller, it is good to have you back on again.
Good to be back. Really great to be with you.
As I just talked about up in the introduction, we ended last time with you and your brother and the challenges that you had housing him in the afterlife of mass incarceration, if I could riff on the subtitle of your book. Give us an update, would you? How's he doing? Where did you find a place for him? And what's the latest?
Well, we found a place for him with a wonderful organization that works to house formerly incarcerated people. You know, he's had some hiccups. He got rearrested a couple times, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But over the last few months, he stabilized, he has a place, he's looking for work. He kind of lost his job the last time he went in, but we're hopeful.
Well, that's good to hear. Not the re-rest part, but the hopeful part. And that gets me to my question about what you've been doing since. You have been working since the last time we spoke on these things that you call moral worlds for those in a post-incarceration life. And I want you to explain, first of all, what that means, and then we can talk about them.
Sure. So I've been very interested for some years now in how we respond to people who've committed acts of violence, largely because I've been very interested in what we do with people we've learned to be afraid of. Right. You know, and so the moral world, as I'm imagining it, are the institutions and people that people who've committed acts of harm bump into and against as they try to make a life for themselves. So I'm very interested in, for example, the role of probation officers, but also mothers, librarians, teachers, who are responding to the needs of people that we've learned to be afraid of, and how this prejudgment kind of shapes the trajectory of their lives from that moment forward.
This is probably a hard question to answer, but how do we unlearn to be afraid of the people that you have been studying about?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I'm not sure that we begin by unlearning fear. I think we start from a position of inclusion, despite how we feel, that we base how we respond to people who've committed acts of harm, violent acts even, based on what we believe to be the right thing to do, not based on how we feel from moment to moment. And there are 100 reasons why I'm making this point, but I'm sure there's a follow-up question. So
No, keep going, actually, because this is the root of the work you've been doing, I think, right? It's the trust that we have in giving them our trust, right?
That's absolutely right. And so there's 100 years of criminological literature that supports the idea that the response to crime, the response to violence that we see that works best is, in fact, us allowing ourselves to be vulnerable. You know, what we've done is more or less the opposite. You know, someone's committed, and it makes sense. Someone's committed a harmful act. We have reason to be afraid of this person. And in response to that fear, we've built institutions, we've built entire markets, labor markets, we've written laws and policies that push them away, that keep them far away from us. But the literature tells us that when people have access to the things they need, the material resources they need, but also communities that trust them, that's when we see crime reduction. That's when we see people turn from behaviors that we don't like. So the more we run, the more we hide from the problem, the less we face it, the more of the problem we end up with. What I'm suggesting is that we figure out how to embrace people who've caused acts of harm, which seems counterintuitive, but it is, in fact, what the literature suggests works.
Give me an example. Tell me a story from your research.
Oh, 100%. So there's a drug robber, you know, who I call Zoe, who had been, you know, locked away for many things. The last time he had been locked away was because he shot someone. And the person survived, thankfully. And he did, you know, 15 years altogether, about 15 years. And he comes home. He needs a place to stay. He's living at a halfway house that, in this case, the halfway house, you know, wasn't the best. It charged its residents' rent. It was charging Zoe about $400 a month, and he had no way to get it. Yeah. He's taking a walk around the block. You know, nobody would hire him because he's got this felony for a violent act. And what does he see on the corner? But, quote, two dope boys flashing their cash, talking their stuff is what he is what he tells me. Yeah. And he's sitting here faced with this dilemma. You know, should I rob them? You know, I need the money because I can't be evicted. If I'm evicted, I can go back to jail because homelessness, not having an address is a violation of parole. But he makes a decision, a very hard decision not to. And he gets on a bus and he goes to a halfway house and he knocks a different halfway house, a good organization that offers people a chance to sort of thrive in their own ways. And he knocks on the door, but they don't have room for him. They say there's a waiting list, but they say, tell you what, we'll let you sleep on the couch. And if you can just ride out this wait while we're waiting on a bed to open, then we'll allow you in. And they do. They hire him as a groundskeeper. He gets promoted from groundskeeper to case manager. 10 years later, he's a program manager. He runs the program. He's now the executive director of that program. And he hasn't committed another crime since. But they took a chance on him. They trusted him, and it paid off.
So that organization obviously has done an amazing thing for this guy. And you know, you focus on them and it's your research, so you get to do what you want. I wonder, though, if the key moment in that whole thing wasn't him standing there in the street corner and saying, no, I'm not going to rob these guys. I need to do something else. And I guess my question is, how do we get to get more people in his situation, in Zoe's situation, to make that decision, right? Because that's the linchpin.
Well, he had to see an alternative in that moment, too. He remembered this organization. And what I didn't mention was that he heard about it in prison. So what the organization did was they sent people on the inside to talk about the kinds of programs that they offered. But he saw opportunity is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. This is going to sound flip, but it's marketing by this halfway house, right? That's what it was.
100%. 100%. Yeah. But the kind of marketing really matters. So it is marketing, but it's the kind of marketing that says there's a place for you here. We don't care what you did. We understand you made a mistake, but we believe you can change, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. It does occur to me, though, that taking that chance, and look, halfway houses are in that line of work, but many
That's
other
right.
companies and businesses and people in this economy are not. It's not without risk taking that chance on a person.
No, that there is absolutely risk involved. And this is why vulnerability is necessary. And this is why I think we have to move away from the fear-based responses that we've had for so long. Because what's required to move past any sort of conflict, it kind of doesn't matter where you look in the world. There are all these stories of people who receive, for example, former child soldiers. And the thing that gets the child soldier from engaging in the action of harming other people is that moment of embrace where someone says, I know you've caused harm, but there's a place for you here. But to the point about risk, there is risk because people could, for example, mess up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so right now, for example, I just left this morning, you know, before this call, an organization called Chicago CRID. And the entire basis of this program, it's run by, it was founded by Arne Duncan.
Oh, yeah. Former Secretary of Education, yeah.
That's absolutely right. And the entire basis of this program is that if people are given opportunities, you know, access to employment, therapy that they might need, the kind of counseling that they might need, and the training, both the hard skills and the soft skills to be productive in the economy, once given the opportunity, they'll take it and they'll thrive. And I was talking to them about their job placement. And their job placement is fantastic. It's, you know, it's in the last year, they had something like 150 or 160 people. They placed 2/3 of them in either part-time or full-time jobs, and those people are able to keep their jobs.
So if part of your calling in doing this work, because clearly it's a calling for you, as we talked about in the first interview, and your brother and your family and all of that, if part of your calling in this work is to proselytize for people who are formerly incarcerated, right, and to carry their burden to the non-incarcerated public, which is most of us, if you could get, I was going to say President Biden, but really it's not a federal thing, right? It's a state thing and a local thing. If you could all 50 governors in sequence on the phone, what would the message be?
Okay, so I think that the 50 governors and President Biden have to take inclusion seriously, that it's not a buzzword. And we have to ask what full democratic participation looks like. What does it mean to be able to fully operate in the political economy and culture? That the folks who committed violent acts, even violent crimes, and this is one of the reasons why I'm focusing on violence now, because it's such a hot issue. It's so hard to get our head around what to do with somebody who's hurt someone. But they'll only change if they're given the opportunity to change. And that opportunity to change should include the opportunity to thrive. It can't just be the job at McDonald's. It can't just, I mean, McDonald's is wonderful. You know, and McDonald's should hire people who have records. You know, it's, you know, hire people. I might stop at McDonald's after this interview. Like who knows? But that can't be the horizon. Their horizon can't be based on it just in the service industry. Folks need to lead. Think of them as any other human being who's, but just one who's made a mistake. That would be my message to them.
What you are asking for here, not unreasonably at all, is for the non-incarcerated public and people who are not familiar with the stresses and strains and the costs and the burdens of carceral America, right? You are asking for a certain amount of grace from the wider population. And I guess I wonder what gives you hope that you will get that grace?
Well, two things. You know, one is the fact that half of American families who have a loved one who's done time. The fact that something like 1/3 of American adults have a criminal record of some sort, that while 49% of Black boys have been arrested before they turn the age of 23, 38% of white boys in this country, and I say boys, will be arrested before they turn the age of 23. And so I think that that's forcing us to wrestle with this problem head on. And I think the place to start is the hard place. I think that the mistake we've made is we've been tinkering around the edges because we've been trying to find the most sympathetic figure that we can help, the nonviolent, non-serious, non-sexual offender. And while it makes a lot of sense because it's the easiest thing to do politically, the truth of the matter is most people make mistakes and they make bad ones. You know, and so when we look inside the jail or prison, about half of the folks who are locked away are locked away for a crime of violence. I also think that the real measure of one's moral compass is about how you respond to people that you don't like. What needs to happen is people have to pretend as if they believe that these folks are human beings and they deserve a human community that responds to them. Pretend as if you believe it and start from that place. That's the place to legislate from. That's the place to think about your hiring practices from. Even if you're a little afraid yourself, it's about doing the right thing, not being motivated by how something feels in a moment.
We first talked to Reuben Jonathan Miller 3-ish, 4 years ago about his book. It was called Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. As you have just heard, he has been busy since. Professor Miller, thanks for your time, sir. I do appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.